to be among God's people today, and I'm glad that God's power is at work. I sense that already in a number of ways, including Josh's opening and in one of the last songs we sang. I'll not read all of the verses, but I could. Frankly, the tune doesn't grab me that much, but the words are really powerful. I'd like to read the first stanza. Forth in thy name, O Lord, I go, my daily labor to pursue. Thee, only thee, resolved to know in all I think or speak or do. I trust that will be the heart throb of the message this morning. I trust that's what you will come away with. I'd like to start this part four of my series on thinking and communicating with a story and a review of what I've covered so far. Indeed, it's just a little hard to consider this a series given the length of time between installments, but so it goes. The story. A few weeks ago, Brent and I were discussing a financial matter, the details of which I will mercifully withhold. The discussion took an early negative turn when I quickly dismissed a suggestion from Brenda about how to justify a purchase. We track our spending in most areas, and she thought we could help justify a significant purchase by, in our minds, writing off part of it as a contribution. Now, we'd been through this discussion before, and Brenda knew my perspective on the matter. I would call my viewpoint clearly defined. Brenda would call it narrow, or intolerant, or unreasonable. So I replied to her suggestion with a rather dismissive comment, something like, that wouldn't be right, or we couldn't do that. Now, please understand this has nothing to do with tax legality here. We're a long way from benefiting from itemized deductions. But for me, it was only to track personal finances and what for me was an issue of integrity in the way we track them. Well, my dismissive response was not well received. And you might say the discussion became more lively. That discussion was mercifully cut short because I needed to leave for work. But we left that discussion with neither of us feeling heard or understood. In fact, it took a while for either of us to feel like discussing it again. At some point, Brenda asked me if I was still upset at her for not considering my perspective to be the only valid one. Well, I was a little taken aback because, well, obviously both of us were just feeling like the other was saying, the only right way is my way. So you should probably be thinking by now, so he is preaching on finding truth in other people's perspectives. I wonder why he's not putting it to practice. That's a very good question. Why is it that when the rubber meets the road, I struggle with knowing what is compromising integrity and what is charitable acceptance of another person's viewpoint? How would you have handled this situation? Now let me guess that most of you are itching right now to know the details so that you can decide which one of us is right. That just underscores my point. Most of us have opinions on issues such as this, and those opinions are based on our perspectives. What else can we do? If our perspective weren't right, we wouldn't think so, right? So how do we let the truth of others, even if it's partial, bring us closer to that full truth? Now allow me to ask another question. It sounds like I'm endorsing respecting other people's positions, and I mentioned that others have truth. Now, clearly, I'm referring to people we don't agree with. So I ask you, how is what I'm recommending any different from the most common response that I think you'll get if you try to share the gospel with anybody in the U.S. who is, say, my age or younger? Who would venture a guess as to what that response is? Exactly. That may be true for you, but it's not necessarily true for me. And you know, if that's the refrain, one of the verses in there somewhere is, judge not that you don't be judged. So we call that moral relativism. And what is your answer to that? Most of us, I think, here believe in universal truth, and that this truth reflects reality. That is, I think, what we consider the definition of truth. So when we're confronted with a that's true for you statement, do we simply bite our lip and walk away? What do we do when saying the Bible says so doesn't convince our listeners? Before I dive into answering that question, I think a review is in order, and this will take longer than I wish it would, but it's been 3 months since the last message I preached in the series, and much longer since I started, so you probably remember precious little of what I've said before. I'd like to refresh you on several viewpoints regarding truth. Or actually, more accurately, knowledge of reality. That should be close. I'm not going to read them all. They're up here, compliments of Paul Hebert and his book, Anthropological Reflections, is part of the title. I'll just read the ones that I've covered before. The second one here, he calls naive realism or positivism. Here is how it explains the nature of knowledge, or here is how naive realism answers the question, how do we know what we know? It starts by saying the external world is real. It says further that the mind can know it, the external world, can know reality, exactly, exhaustively, and without bias. Knowledge equals reality. In other words, knowledge has a one-to-one relationship with reality. Strong statement. Now, if a naive realist would answer the question, why do you call a particular pitch a strike? Here is what he might say. I call it the way it is. If it is a strike, I call it a strike. If it is a ball, I call it a ball. Now, as I've said before, each of these on this list have some positive element, but I don't consider them equally viable in answering the question, how do we know what we know? All but one of them on this list have glaring faults that I believe can be used to point the way to a superior position, the one that will serve us best in answering that question. And by the way, this question is pretty closely related to the question Pilate asked at Jesus' trial when he said, what is truth? In my message on naive realism, I talked about Job's friends as viewing life from this perspective. They were confident that what they observed and understood from history was a complete revelation of truth. They were saying, in essence, that if they didn't know it, it wasn't reality. In relation to Job's sufferings, they asserted that the righteous prosper and the wicked don't. So if Job was suffering, the only possible explanation was that he wasn't righteous. Over and over, his friends said, everything that we have observed, everything our forefathers have observed, points to the same conclusion. If you are suffering, you have done something wrong. Job never did find that representation of truth acceptable. He said, in essence, that may be part of the picture. That may be true for part of this of the time, but it can't be the whole picture. There is something incomplete about it. And in the end, God affirmed that Job was right. Do you remember that God said of Job's friends, they have not spoken truth of me as you have. There was more to the picture than either Job or his friends were seeing, and Job was right. I'd like to return to an illustration that I find helpful in discussing these positions on knowledge and how we know knowledge. So, any of the people on the front row recognize what this is? It's pretty easy to tell. I've got it right there at the top. It says Center Platt. It comes from this book that probably most people around here have. It's called a Platt or a Platt map. You have to read the notes here at the bottom, and it's kind of small writing, but you have to read the notes at the bottom to kind of get the full benefit of this. From what you can tell, though, would you say that this plat is accurate? Those of you who can read it? General agreement? It's of our township here, of which Center is somewhere right up in here. The church, yes. It's Center Township, and Center Church is right up there in the corner. So it looks like it represents reality. Now, let me display another map here. This is a directory of Center Township. From what you can tell, let's see, you'd have to read the notes here to really get full use of it. Let me just make a couple of comments about it here. You can see that Center, actually, let me just do a switch right here. I'll switch to a zoomed-in version of this. Here's the directory. There you can see that Center is right there, and let's see, Titus and Mary Jane live right there, and Edwin lives right there. Whoops. It's close to accurate. And let me see here. Number 3, Melvin and Fanny. Oh, they live south of Marvin and Rosa. A few problems here. But if we took care of those discrepancies, would you agree that this map is accurate? Yes, okay. So it reflects reality. Well, there's a problem here, isn't there? We said this reflects reality, we said this reflects reality, but they're not the same thing. How could that work? For example, the directory shows Ellen Knisley to be living about, I think, right there. But the plat shows that Titus Knisley has that land. I think Ellen would be just a bit concerned if Titus would stick this plat in his hip pocket and proceed to extend his new fence across along the road in front of Ellen's house and then turn his cattle out into her garden. Can't you just see him? Well, it says here that I own this 80, so I'm going to make use of it. A little problem there, isn't there? We all recognize that the center plat, of necessity, only represents a part of reality. It represents reality, but only a part. And the people compiling it had very specific goals. And they implemented, and how they implemented them is precisely explained in the introduction. Here's what it says. Small tracts less than 5 acres are not shown in our plat maps. Simple enough. But if Titus were to accept this as the only representation of reality, then he would decide that he is justified in grazing his cows on Ellen's corn. So we do well to remember that any map is only a partial representation of reality. Just like no person's perspective fully represents truth. We also do well to remember that another person's perspective isn't simply wrong because it is different from ours. We need to consider, I believe, three possibilities. Number one, that our perspective is wrong. Number two, that their perspective is wrong. Or number three, that we may be able to combine our maps for a more complete picture, for a more full representation of reality. Now, I've obviously been comparing naive realism with critical realism here, and let me just read now how a critical realist views the nature of knowledge. First part, on the first part, they agree the external world is real. Here's where they differ. Our knowledge of it is partial but can be true. Apparent contradictions are either different maps partially representing reality, or one of them is wrong. Here's how he would answer the pitch question. I call it as I see it, but there is a real pitch and an objective standard against which I must judge it. I can be proven right or wrong. The last category that Paul Hebert includes in his list is where I will pick up today. Again, I started here last time. He calls it instrumentalism or pragmatism. And it is another category that is almost too broad to be safely lumped under one heading. I have to admit, when I started digging into this one, I felt like I had hit my limit. Reading people like Charles Sanders Peirce and William James and John Dewey, I realized I was in over my head. I have no background in philosophy, and their vocabulary and concepts were more than I could wrap my mind around. What I did understand makes me say about pragmatism what I've said more generally about these positions, and that is that it has some elements in its defense. It raises some questions that need answers, and it has some answers that have merit. But as I understand it, it still has one fundamental flaw, and that is that it does not accept the existence of truth independent of perception. Let me just read what it says here. The external world is real. We cannot know if our knowledge of it is true, but if it does the job or if it works, we use it. That is how we determine knowledge. That is how we determine truth, actually. And here is the answer to the pitch question. I call it the way I see it, but there is no way to know if I am right or wrong. Nobody else can know whether it was a ball or a strike. Is that satisfactory for you? Remember that I said that pragmatism does not accept the existence of truth outside of perception. Let me read to you Peirce, Charles Peirce's definition of truth. He says, the opinion which is fated to be ultimately agreed to by all who investigate is what we mean by truth. And the object represented by this opinion is real. That is the way I would explain reality. The opinion which is fated to be ultimately agreed to by all who investigate is what we mean by truth. So that's truth. The best we can hope for is for agreement by all who investigate. Satisfactory? Once we have agreement, then we have truth, and then we can know the reality that that truth represents. But until then, there is no such thing as truth. Can we live with that? In other words, truth hinges on us and our perception. We determine what truth is. In my last message, I tried to show that from Deuteronomy, and you can turn to Deuteronomy 4, and from the Psalms, that God intended to communicate that there is indeed one true, transcendent God over all nations and for all time, and that he embodies universal, timeless truth. Here's one of the Psalms that affirms this. Let's just look at the first one here. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will bow down before him, for dominion belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. The psalmist says this is more than just a national god or a tribal god. This is the God of all the earth. Let's also read Deuteronomy 4, 5 through 8. See, I have taught you decrees and laws as the Lord my God commanded, so that you may follow them in the land you are entering to take possession of it. Observe them carefully, for this will show your wisdom and understanding to the nations who will hear about all these decrees and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. What other nation is so great as to have their gods near them the way the Lord our God is near us whenever we pray to him? And what other nation is so great as to have such righteous decrees and laws as this body of laws I am setting before you today? God was intending that his laws would be viewed as right for all nations. Now, if God is a universal God and his laws are universal, can't we say that truth lies deeper than an individual's or even a nation's understanding of it? If the only measure of our understanding of truth is, does it work, or do we agree on it, what is the result? I'd like to look at the book of Judges as a case study on the practical and logical outcome of this philosophy. You can turn to Judges if you'd like. If you try stringing the ruling periods of the Judges together end to end, you soon run into some complications. Those that have studied this closely generally agree that the judges of this period were not typically ruling over the whole nation. And there are plenty of clues, I think, from the text that would lend to that. More likely, they had jurisdiction over one or several tribes. Just for an example, look at chapter 6, verse 34 and 35. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, summoning the Abiezrites to follow him. He sent messengers throughout Manasseh, calling them to arms, and also into Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, so they too went up to meet them. So here were four tribes that were called when Gideon went to battle against the Midianites. It seems that in general, the tribes were not actively maintaining their identity as a nation of Israel. There are cases of actually tribes fighting each other, such as chapter 12 with Jephthah and the Ephraimites. Worse yet, there was fighting within the same tribe in neighboring cities. This happened in chapter 9 after Gideon's son Abimelech murdered his 70 brothers so that he could be king of Shechem. He was eventually killed, but only after having completely destroyed the city that crowned him king. If you haven't read it recently, you should. It's a strange story, but it is only one of many in the book of Judges. Even Gideon used capital punishment on the men of Peniel, maybe, after he finished destroying the Midianites, because they didn't give his troops food when they were going in battle. So, in this quick little survey, what would you say is the purpose of this compilation of strange stories? Here is Barnes' analysis. He would say that the writer intends to focus the reader on the doctrine of the unity of God. I quote, "All the calamities which he, the writer, was about to narrate were the fruit and consequence of idolatry." All the calamities were the fruit and consequence of idolatry. Barnes suggests that one of the main objectives of the Old Testament was to keep this doctrine of the unity of God alive until the coming of Christ. But you ask, why is a whole book of the Old Testament devoted to negative examples of idolatry? Well, let me hasten to say that there are more than just negative examples in the book. God clearly demonstrates that he is still in control, and he will accomplish his purposes, and that through flawed human beings. But I propose further that the foundational principle of one universal God and his universal truth is essential to existence. That's a foundational principle that humans need to have. It is so important that God gave us a full book's worth of gut-wrenching evidence of what happens when this principle is ignored. To get a feel for this neglect, let's read just a few excerpts from the book. I'm going to start in chapter 2, verse 10, and actually I'm going to read the rest of that chapter. Chapter 2, verse 10. After that whole generation had been gathered to their fathers, that was the generation that was involved in the initial conquest of Canaan. Another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and they served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the peoples around them. They provoked the Lord to anger because they forsook him and served Baal and the Asherahs. In his anger against Israel, the Lord handed them over to raiders who plundered them. He sold them to their enemies all around, whom they were no longer able to resist. Whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of the Lord was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them. They were in great distress. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders. Yet they would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to other gods and worshipped them. Unlike their fathers, they quickly turned from the way in which their fathers had walked, the way of obedience to the Lord's commands. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived. For the Lord had compassion on them as they groaned under those who oppressed and afflicted them. But when the judge died, the people returned to ways even more corrupt than those of their fathers, following other gods and serving and worshiping them. They refused to give up their evil practices and stubborn ways. Therefore, the Lord was very angry with Israel and said, "Because this nation has violated the covenant that I laid down for their forefathers and has not listened to me, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations Joshua left when he died. I will use them to test Israel and see whether they will keep the way of the Lord and walk in it as their forefathers did." The Lord had allowed those nations to remain. He did not drive them out at once by giving them into the hands of Joshua. Now just skim with me for a few other quick references to this over the next several chapters. Verse 7 of chapter 3, "The Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. They forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Asherahs." Verse 12, "Once again the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And because of this evil, the Lord gave Eglon, king of Moab, power over Israel." Chapter 4, verse 1, "After Ehud died, the Israelites once again did evil in the eyes of the Lord. So the Lord sold them to the hands of Jabin, king of Canaan." And then after Deborah's song, in chapter 6, verse 1, "Again the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years he gave them over into the hands of the Midianites," and so on and so forth. You get the picture. That is the story of the judges. I struggled to know where to go with this and what to highlight in the book, but it seemed most relevant to me to do what I'd really rather avoid. And that is take a brief look at the last two accounts in the book. Believe me, I'm going to be glad when I'm finished with this section. You can turn to chapter 17 next. Scholars generally agree, and it makes sense to me, that these last chapters form kind of an appendix to the main book. The stories of the judges are sequential in some form, possibly chronological, but these two accounts were appended possibly because of their significance, but not necessarily between the death of Samson and the priesthood of Eli in 1 Samuel. Notice, too, that these stories make no reference to a particular judge, which could indicate that no judge was actually active during these times. Actually, what I'd like to highlight out of these two stories requires very little effort. It just jumps out at you. It's such a bizarre collage of values and a bewildering syncretism in every chapter. The syncretism in this case is a mixing of idols, idol worship, with Yahweh worship. It is this chaos that I propose is the result of the observation that shows up twice in this book, and I mentioned them last time. It's found in chapter 17, verse 6, and also in chapter 21, verse 25. I quote, "In those days there was no king in Israel, but every man did that which was right in his own eyes." This chaos, I believe, is the product of that. You can understand why I don't want to read this, so let's just briefly scan these two accounts. First of all, we start with this strange case of Micah stealing from his mother. His mother uttering a curse about the thief, Micah overhearing it, and then, "Oh, here's your money." And then the mother says, "Lord, bless you, my son." And he gives her the money, but she gives it back to him, and he makes a carved image and a cast idol. So he now makes a shrine for this carved image and the idol, and an ephod, and he installs one of his sons as the priest there, and then somehow a Levite from Benjamin comes, and he asks the Levite to be a priest there. Anyway, seems like a strange arrangement. "The Lord bless you, my son, and now let's make some idols with the silver that you returned to me." And then the Danites go through, and they ask the Levite if their journey is going to be successful. So he inquires of the Lord, and it says they asked him to inquire of God, and the priest answered, "Go in peace. Your journey has the Lord's approval." Anyway, so they go check things out, and then they come back through, and this time they nab the priest and the idols, and Micah realizes he's overpowered, and so he lets them do it. The rest of the chapter is about the Danites' conquest. Then in chapter 19, here's the Levite who goes to get his concubine who left him. A concubine does not quite have the same status as a full wife, but it was clear that she had a lot of the properties of a wife. He is called her husband. Her father is called his father-in-law. He speaks comfortingly to her to try to draw her back, etc. You remember the story probably. After many delays, he finally leaves, decides not to stay with the Jebusites because they're not Israelites, and so, you know, you wouldn't want to run too big a risk there. Instead, he stays with the at Gibeah, and the people there are notably inhospitable, except for one old man who takes them in, and then the men of the city realize that there is some pleasure to be had here, and they try to get the Levite for their purposes, and that to thwart that, the Levite forcibly pushes his concubine out to them. They ravage her all night. The Levite comes out the next morning and discovers she's dead. He finally is perturbed and cuts her up into pieces and sends one to each of the 12 tribes of Israel. And they come together in alarm and shock and say this has to be dealt with. And they go to battle. In that battle, the Lord seems to tell them who's supposed to start and how they're supposed to approach this thing. But in the first day of the battle, the 11 tribes lose 22,000 men, and the Benjamites are virtually unscathed. Do it again the next day, once again at the Lord's direction, and another 18,000 are killed. And then finally, the third day, they use a different strategy, and it works, and the Benjamites are almost completely annihilated. And then there's a little more yet about how they saved the Benjamite tribe because they just couldn't bear to see it destroyed. With some really strange logic in that section too. Have you had enough? I certainly have. If you're like me, this raises a lot of questions. Questions like, back to the story of Micah's priest, did God really give his approval through the priest who was taking care of Micah's idols? Or how about in the battle between the 11 tribes and Benjamin, if God was really wanting to punish the tribe of Benjamin, why did he allow 40,000 soldiers from the 11 tribes to be killed? I can assure you that time is not the main reason that I'm not going to answer these questions and all the others. I don't have answers. But again, let me extract from these chapters what to me is abundantly clear. Chaos results when every man does what is right in his own eyes. Chaos results when every man defines truth by what seems right to him. Chaos results when we say that universal truth exists only when we agree on it. I'd like to move forward now, 4,000 years or so, and spend a little time in our current scene, yet by quoting a prominent proponent of pragmatism. Now, I want to acknowledge that in a discussion like this, we run the risk of having a conversation that goes something like this. Person A says, this is an apple. Person B says, no, this isn't orange. Person A says, of course it's not orange. It's an apple. And person B says, no, you don't understand. It isn't orange. See what's happening? We're completely missing each other. And this can happen because we're thinking in different terms or using different definitions. But so if that's where you're at, if my limited perspective is producing more questions than answers for you, then please talk with me about it, or better yet, actually go talk to somebody who understands this stuff better than I do. Now, back to this question of current positions on pragmatism, current proponents of pragmatism. One thing I think we need to understand about these proponents on this position of knowledge is that they're not simply weirdos. Many of those that bother to wrestle and write about this are generally thoughtful and are trying to come up with a satisfactory explanation of reality, one that is unified and logical. Now, not everybody who lives out pragmatism is doing so deliberately. They have latched onto what has become a cultural norm because it is a convenient way of living life the way they want to. But as an example of those who wrestle with it, I'd like to cite Charles Sanders Peirce, the one I quoted from earlier. In my reading of him, and again, this wasn't in depth, but in my reading of him, I found him to be humble and gracious in his presentation of ideas. Further, his mental capacity and the way he used it makes me look puny. But having said that, I am still presumptuous enough to differ with his outcome. Take, for example, an essay he wrote in 1908 entitled a neglected argument for the reality of God. In that essay, he is arguing for the reality of God. He begins with a complex explanation of terms and concepts, but his basic argument says that if a person muses or meditates on the idea of God long enough and intensely enough, he will find it not only appealing, but life-changing. Brace yourself. Try wading with me through these two dense quotes. The more a person ponders it, the idea of God's reality, the more it will find response in every part of his mind for its beauty, for its supplying an ideal of life, and for its thoroughly satisfactory explanation of his whole threefold environment. I do not think that I ought to be less assured that any normal man who considers the hypothesis of God's reality and pursues that line of reflection in scientific singleness of heart will come to be stirred to the depths of his nature by the beauty of the idea and by its august practicality, even to the point of earnestly loving, I should turn this off, I guess, earnestly loving and adoring his strictly hypothetical God, and to the point of desiring above all things to shape the whole conduct of life and all the springs of action into conformity with that hypothesis. Now, to be deliberately and thoroughly prepared to shape one's conduct into conformity with a proposition is neither more nor less than the state of mind called believing that proposition. Dense, I understand. It's you can understand why I read that many times. You'll also notice that I was excerpting here. You run a risk when you do that, because I may be misrepresenting him. I don't intend to. I think I've done it accurately, but if you want to, check out the original source and see if you agree with my conclusions here. Pierce is saying, first of all, that a person, by carefully musing or meditating, can form the idea of the reality of God so clearly in his mind that it will provide him a satisfactory explanation of life. He says further that by reflecting deeply enough and with singleness of heart on this concept of God, he can even come to want to conform all his actions and all his thoughts, his whole life, around this concept of God. You could almost use the term obedience in that context. Bring his whole being into obedience to this concept of God. Now, except for one glaring problem, I could almost live with this explanation of our perception of God, because we do agree, we acknowledge, that our belief in God is a matter of faith. So maybe this is just one way of describing what happens in our mind, right? But I mentioned the glaring problem. Let's look briefly at the lives of two men to illustrate this problem. Who wants to identify the man on the left? Did I hear it? Osama bin Laden? And the man on the right? Menno Simons. These two men, I think most of us would agree, pursued, in Pierce's terms, their line of reflection on the hypothesis of God's reality, if we can call it that, with singleness of heart. I think we would agree that they did so to the point of desiring above all things to shape the whole conduct of life and all the springs of actions into conformity with that hypothesis. Didn't they each give themselves to their concept of God? Bin Laden had a carefully shaped concept of God, and he held unswervingly to that concept. Menno Simons had a concept of God, and he held unswervingly to that concept. Further, each of the carefully shaped concepts was the result of agreement among those who investigated it. They were not isolated. They were acting in agreement with others around them. So, as Pierce defined true, each of them should have should have been true. So here's the problem. How can we affirm both of these hypotheses, that both of these hypotheses of God are right? Don't be distracted by the fact that one of these is Muslim and the other is Christian. The central problem here is that their respective hypotheses of God's reality are opposed in the extreme. If you aren't sure about that, try these quotes. I'll read the quote from bin Laden first. "The ruling to kill the Americans and their allies is an individual duty for every Muslim who can do it in any country in which it is possible to do it." Let me read that again. "The ruling to kill the Americans and their allies is an individual duty for any Muslim, for every Muslim who can do it in any country in which it is possible to do it. This is in accordance with the words of Almighty Allah, quote, 'And fight the pagans altogether as they fight you altogether, and fight them until there is no more tumult or oppression, and there prevail justice and faith in Allah,' end quote." Menno Simons: "The regenerated do not go to war, nor engage in strife. They are the children of peace who have beaten their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks and know of no war. Since we are to be conformed to the image of Christ, how can we then fight our enemies with the sword? Spears and swords of iron we leave to those who, alas, consider human blood and swine's blood of well-nigh equal value." Try to lay aside the fact that you more nearly embrace the view of one of these men than the other. Can we accept that these two perspectives are equally valid hypotheses of the reality of God? Can we affirm them as mutually compatible because they gave direction and purpose to the men who held them and to the people who now hold them as well? I can't. I cannot believe that any amount of investigation, any amount of study will bring about an opinion that satisfactorily reconciles these two extremes. They could possibly both be wrong, but they can't possibly both be right. I submit that there is a universal truth against which both of these concepts of God can be measured. Hence, pragmatism that says, if it works for you, if it's true for you and your society, whoever that is, that pragmatism is not a satisfactory answer to the question of how we know what we know. Rather than on a negative note, I'd like to end on a positive note. If that isn't the answer, here is my answer. My faith has found a resting place, not in device or creed. I trust the ever-living one. His wounds for me shall plead. I need no other argument. I need no other plea. It is enough that Jesus died and that he died for me. Let's bow for prayer. Oh Lord, in humility, we come before you just readily acknowledging that our little minds can't grasp you in full. But we also acknowledge that you have chosen because of your love for us to reveal yourself to us, to reveal truth to us, so that we are not simply wandering aimlessly, left with guessing, left with trying to find truth by simply agreeing on it with each other. You have chosen to reveal yourself, to reveal truth to us. So we come confessing that you are a universal God and that you represent universal truth And we again commit ourselves to seeking to find that truth and to bring our lives into conformity with that universal truth, not simply with our concept of it. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you, Brother Arlen. It seems to me that
my faith has found a resting place, not in device or creed. I trust the ever-living One is, whose for me shall plead. I need no other argument, I need no Jesus died, and that He died for me. Enough for me that Jesus died, this ends my fear and doubt. A sinful soul, I come to Him, He'll never cast me out. I need no other argument, I need no other plea. It is enough that Jesus died, and that He died for me. My hope is leaning on the died, and that He died.